I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Today, the UN Security Council turns its attention to Syria, torn apart by neocon wars of balkanization and sectarian chaos, engineered by Washington with NATO vassal states and Israel. They've bombed or armed the bombing of Damascus, as well as Iran, Lebanon, Yemen, and Gaza, where the genocide continues as Donald Trump now threatens Russia. This is the same Trump who once promised to end forever wars, to drain the swamp of corrupt bureaucrats, as he now stumbles through backlash from his own base over his links to Mossad agent Jeffrey Epstein. Joining me now is a man credited with shaping the ideological blueprint of the Trump administration. Vice President J.D. Vance cited him back in 2021, and his influence is extended to Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, Elon Musk, and Rumble and Palantir billionaire Peter Thiel. Curtis Yarvin is the author of the political blog Grey Mirror. He joins me now from Berkeley, California. Curtis, thanks so much for coming on. People may not realize that while Trump's younger fans listen to Joe Rogan, White House staffers apparently follow you. And we better make Peter Thiel's Rumble pick of the week with you on this, I have to say. But anyway.
Are we on Rumble?
Yeah, we're on Rumble.
Are we going out on Rumble?
Absolutely. Amazing. Well, look, Trump, I mean, he's finally going after Obama. I don't know why it took him 6 months. And some of the people that tried to undermine him in his first term. He's destroyed USAID, NPR. He's finally got around to do that. Clearly, revolutionary acts. But he's still bombed Yemen. He's still bombed Iran. Here in the UAE, and I know that you know the UAE well, 73 Palestinians killed while waiting for aid. That number, obviously, far higher when this is actually broadcast. Why would people in the Trump administration who read your work, clearly it would inspire them to destroy USAID and cutouts like that. Why would people in the administration be back to forever wars?
It's important to understand how, you know, the U.S. government is unquestionably the most powerful force in the world today. And it's important to understand how it works and why it does what it does. And when you think of it, you know, we're used to sort of reading news stories that says Trump did this, Trump did that. But actually, you know, the complexity of an administration is far more complicated. And, you know, it's especially complicated in this administration because this administration is a really fascinating mix of an attempt to run the administration top down from the Oval Office and the normal bottom-up way that the government is run. And these things are coming into all kinds of different tension in ways that are, you know, very illuminating and sometimes shambolic and sometimes impressive. It's a mix of all of those things.
Yeah, and clearly your philosophy is one that favors top down. But then were you not personally shocked when you hear that people like John Ratcliffe is the CIA and Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor? If it's top down, there are grave dangers.
Yeah, so you know, when you're top down, but you're still basically trying to instruct the DNA of this whole system. And the DNA of this system is not easily changed. It's really not very changed at all. And so you have people trying to adapt to this regime. You have people trying to steer the regime from below. You have the natural sort of incentives of the system. And I think, you know, for example, you mentioned kind of isolationism versus interventionism. And what you discover, what any Republican administration comes in and discovers, is that the sort of the sugar high of sort of playing the traditional Republican role of being like the bold, strong President Reagan, leader of the free world.
But it's his second term. Because Trump has been
But his first term was almost a nullity in a way. And the thing is, you know, in defense of Trump, what's actually amazing to me, what's really surprising, is how different the second term was from the first, because I sort of, my preconception had been no one can learn anything beyond the age of 70. It's ridiculous, right? You know, and the thing is, what we're seeing is actually very different from that. What we're seeing is that actually, there is an attempt to make this, you know, crazy old system like almost operate as if it was, you know, FDR's regime from 80 years ago. Because then, you know, what you're seeing when you look at the US government, really, really big picture, is you're seeing the personal regime of Franklin Roosevelt, which basically was a pretty much a monarchy in his time. I'm not saying FDR was as powerful as MBS, let's say, but like not really far from it. He was really running the government. There were certainly things he couldn't do. In 45, he dies and he's built this kind of dream team of like startup quality executives running this regime that has conquered the world. And as he dies and he replaces himself with this kind of non-entity Truman, power goes down into the state. And basically, every president since then has kind of been presiding over a machine that he has much, much less control of. And so in a way that's characteristically Trumpian, that kind of mixes, you know, naivete with sophistication, Trump just comes in and he's like, all right, I'm going to run this thing this time. And, you know, I compare it to like trying to ride a bicycle that nobody's ridden for 80 years. Like all kinds of things are going to happen. Maybe the bike will go somewhere. Maybe the chain will break. Maybe it will collapse in a pile of rust. And it's very unclear with a lot of these things sort of what will happen. And so in a way, like, you know, for example, in something like, you know, the sort of whole Middle East problem, obviously a big concern here, you basically have these kinds of isolationist, you know, energies, but you also have gigantic systems on both sides. You know, the reason why we can't end the war in the Middle East is that there are Americans on both sides. And there always have been for our entire lives. There's an American Israel lobby and there's an American Arab lobby. And they're both very strong. They both go very deep.
I'm not sure how strong you remember. I don't think the Arab lobby, American Arab lobby, is very strong.
Well, let me give you a personal example of the Arab lobby. So my great uncle Peter Heath was the provost of AUB, American University, Beirut. And then he later became the chancellor of the University of Sharjah, where he sadly passed away. AUB was founded by Protestant missionaries in 1873. And so there's a sort of deep connection of a certain kind of American elite that is basically, you know, sort of the protector of the Arab world. And I think that when you look at it's instructive to compare that conflict with two other conflicts that are going on in the world today. One of them is the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict, and one of them is the India-Pakistan conflict. And when you look at the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict, there are basically no strong forces on either side in America. There's quite a weak Armenia lobby, and there's basically no Azeri lobby. And
news for the Kardashians, clearly. Yeah.
I don't know that the Kardashians are focused on Armenian issues. Maybe they should be. Maybe as they get a little older.
But actually, in all seriousness, that has flared up, and the U.S. is much closer at the moment to Azerbaijan just in the past 6 months of the Trump term.
That's interesting. And, you know, but it's still a small fraction of what goes on in the Middle East conflict. And so when you look, for example, at the conflict over what the Armenians call Artsakh and the Azerbaijanis call Nagorno-Karabakh, it's almost like a war that happened before the American era. And so the Armenians sort of made this kind of tactical mistake of electing a pro-American rather than a pro-Russian president. So when they wanted help from the Russians were like, meh. You know, and because that was their sort of normal guardian in that situation. But what I want to stress is that basically, because there was this kind of disparity in military force, what happened was the Armenians had a Nakba. They lost Artsakh, right? But the thing is, the way they lost Artsakh was not, you know, this continuous 50-year guerrilla, you know, baby-killing terrorist war. They just lost their real estate. And there was, you know, the Azeris, I think, can be a little brutal. Clearly, the Armenians felt that they had to leave, and they all left. And, like, the brutality that you see in Gaza, really, on both sides, comes from this, like, terrible frustration of this unwinnable war that neither side can win, that is basically...
I know you wanted also to compare it with the India-Pakistan.
Kind of level of barbarian.
there as well.
And in India, Pakistan, for me, there was a moment of like, you know, really like a new U.S. foreign policy breaking out in a way that was really, really good for the world. Because in India, Pakistan, if you remember, they were all set up to have a war. And then it was actually Vice President Vance who came out and said, we don't really care about this conflict. And they immediately stopped. Everybody immediately stopped because so much of this stuff is like, let's impress the Americans. Let's impress the international community with how much we're suffering. Let's make this like, and so you have all this drama coming out on both sides, and some of the drama is false and some of the drama is true. And so you have basically like, if you look at these atrocities that are going on in Gaza, for example, a lot of them are coming from, you have these, the sort of the Mizrahi population in Israel that is definitely more Middle Eastern than the rest. And they're just like, they fight by these rules. Why can't we fight by these rules? We're just going to be like, and it's sort of, you know, the feeling that the rules are asymmetric.
But the point is, Trump is the man.
Brutality.
Trump is the man pouring money and weapons way more in the past 6 months than previous presidents have. To Netanyahu, and I suppose that's where I'm coming at you here, is that actually, rather than this mysterious top-down approach, one could argue, especially with the big, beautiful bill and all the money to RTX, Northrop Grumman, and all those companies, that actually Trump is just a servant of Netanyahu. That this top-down approach, certainly in foreign affairs, and it's affecting local policy, home policy, as in on the campuses and all the rest of it. Trump's term is being derailed by Israel to the extent that he bombed Iran.
So I would say that it's a little more complicated than that, which is that you have this giant unmovable thing in the U.S. called Congress. And Congress is basically used to directing the executive branch, and it's become very used to directing the executive branch. And Congress is essentially immune to democracy. So the House of Representatives has its 98% incumbency rate. The Senate has a 90% incumbency rate. And everyone in Congress is the sort of the captive in all these different ways of all these lobbies, all these activist groups, all these sort of whatever. And so in a way, basically, because these systems are so big and so existing, you know, in a way, people compare Trump to Putin. And I would say that one of those comparisons is sort of true in a way that most people think. I think they're both much weaker than people think. And I think that basically the sort of the crucial battleground in a way in U.S. politics is, can Trump actually command or find some way to control the Congress? Because what's amazing about this sort of this war that's on autopilot is actually even Netanyahu has been heard to say Israel needs to detox itself from the U.S. relationship, and meaning specifically the U.S. military relationship. And so I think there's an awareness in various sides, including Israel, that this is a toxic, you know, sort of relationship that actually, like, you know, how is not Israel capable of building its own weapons, right? There's clearly something more to it than this. You know, in the 80s, there was this thing where Israel tried to build its own fighter plane, and the U.S. was like, no, you're going to use F-16s. And so it's like, even Israel, you're like, the U.S. is a puppet of Netanyahu. You could as easily say Netanyahu is a puppet of the U.S.
Hang on, Curtis, we just have to go to a break. Curtis Yarvin, thanks. I'll stop you there. More from the New Right political theorist and author of Grey Mirror after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the accelerationist political philosopher and author of Grey Mirror, Curtis Yarvin. Curtis, you were talking about the huge pressures of the undemocratic U.S. Congress on Donald Trump in part one. But of course, he did pass this big, beautiful bill with all these billions of dollars annoying one of your fans, Elon Musk. Why, given his MAGA base from which he derives power, would he even think of enriching all these companies that are given handouts from state subsidy in the face of what the MAGA base actually want. When, and I have to remind people around the world, I suppose, that life expectancy in, say, Mississippi is 71.9, in Cuba it's 78.
If President Trump had the powers of Fidel Castro, like, I think there's one of the it's hard to imagine what it would even mean for President Trump to have the powers of Fidel Castro. But actually, you know, to make that distinction is really, really crucial. And here's a little kind of way of checking your reality, because when we deal with realities, we fall into the trap of believing in symbols so easily. And so when we look at, you know, the president, the leader of the free world, you know, we look at Charles III, King of England, right? You know, what is he king of? He's king of nothing. His ancestors would consider him a joke, right? They would be like, oh my God, you're embarrassing. Get off stage, right? And so when we look at the U.S. government and the president of the free world, we realize that, you know, definitely President Trump does matter. Definitely, you know, sort of important decisions are taken. And I would say it's no exaggeration to say that Trump 47 is 10 times as powerful as Trump 45. That might even be a low number, you know, because that is how sort of insignificant a Republican president normally is, and he tried to run as a normal sort of regime. But even when you multiply the power of a normal president by normal Republican president by 10, there is still a factor of 100 between Trump today and Fidel Castro. And so the thing is that, or any dictator, any king, any CEO, you know, it's still a very weak position. And so because of that weak position, basically, you know, for example, when there's a bill like this being composed, it's sort of inspired in a way by the White House, but it, of course, has to have all of these compromises and all of these giveaways to all of these people who want to advance it through the committee. When FDR, 90 years ago, was basically passing bills, he would just write the bill in the White House and send it to Congress to be rubber stamped by, as if Congress was like the Supreme Soviet or something. And so I think when we think about, especially in places where, like the Middle East, which are very comfortable with autocracy, which understand autocracy, and then they read these things coming out of the U.S. that say President Trump did this, President Trump did that, President Trump did X, you know, you will frequently see stories saying President Trump did something when in fact he had no knowledge at all of this thing. And so, like, the way that you have to kind of read.
Well, let alone the propaganda, sort of course, which is clearly.
Let alone the propaganda.
Which is going to suffer with the cuts, which is going to suffer from the cuts in USAID, because there's less of the propaganda, arguably.
God.
But you were saying about his power. One crucial element of his power, which manifested itself, is that he didn't continue as it was continuing under Genocide Joe and Holocaust Harris, as we call him in this region, the war on Russia through Ukraine, because he clearly has cut the subsidy, the U.S. subsidy to Zelensky. But now he's threatening them again. What's your take on what Trump is doing as regards that, given that
Trump
that is clearly where he has power, and the whole earth would be annihilated if the wrong decision is taken on that?
Okay. Yeah, and the thing is, and I think actually, like, he has power, and I think that one of the places actually where presidential power played a very important role was actually the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan could not have happened without both Trump and Biden personally doing it, because
Curtis Yarvin
everyone
supports
in the deep
Joe
state
Biden.
Wanted
is
that war.
Curtis Yarvin supports
oh, yeah.
Joe Biden.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I wanted to see 4 more years of Biden, if only because I wanted to see this shambling dementia patient, you know, at the head of this regime. I was surprised by the energy that Trump has brought to it. But in Afghanistan, the whole deep state wanted this war. They were kind of tired of it. They kind of knew it was wrong. And I think Joe Biden made the personal decision to say, no, we're going to go ahead and finish that Trump withdrawal. But with Ukraine, it's just, it's a monstrous, monstrous situation. And it's basically the, you know, Putin, who's winning the war, is not going to give Trump an easy off ramp. You know, he has no reason to give Trump an easy off ramp. And so it's like, you know, it's a very, very, very difficult problem, basically. And the instincts of Trump are basically, Trump is a completely intuitive thinker. He's completely intuitive. He's completely mercurial. When he makes a deal, he will turn on a dime. It's something that we just haven't seen in this country before. And so in a way, when you look at, you know, Trump is really trying to make a deal on Ukraine, that much is certain, but it's a really, really hard deal to make in this situation.
And given that it's a top-down administration, then signals from people like Marco Rubio and others clearly not in tune with any revolutionary Trump MAGA agenda are clearly gonna stop any positive.
Well,
policy.
You know, I've been surprised by, like, what you get with someone like, say, you know, I don't know Rubio, I've never met Rubio, but, you know, he was certainly a very pliable neocon in his time. And I think that you're going to have a lot of people in any sort of regime who are actuated by competence and ambition and basically are sort of willing to follow orders as long as those orders fit with their competence and ambition. And I think we're seeing that, you know, from Rubio. The danger is, of course, when, you know, that sort of shifts. Like, it's hard to maintain this sort of continuous, you know, strategic through line. And so it's certainly true. I would love to see a much more isolationist Trump administration. I think there are, like, considerably more possibilities with that. And I think that, you know, a lot of kind of peacemaking could be done in that way. But it's also really, really hard because the whole pool, you've got, you know, I was looking at the number of Trump administration, you know, political appointees that have been, you know, confirmed by the Senate. And the number is something like 94. Like, the Senate is definitely slow rolling Trump appointees.
You don't think which, Steve Bannon, you don't think Marjorie Taylor Greene, you don't think Rand Paul.
She's not in the Senate. No, I think Mitch McConnell, I think basically because the whole Republican establishment understands that Trump is their mortal enemy. They get that. They're actually much more fond of the Democrats because they basically realize that, you know, essentially, here's something, you know, that will resonate in the Middle East. You know, how long has the Republican Party been controlled opposition? Well, in 1940, FDR runs for an unprecedented third term. His opponent, Wendell Willkie, agrees on him as a fellow globalist internationalist. Willkie was a Democrat until 6 months before the, or was a Republic, was a Democrat until 6 months before the election. And so he does this very third worldy thing of running one of his own guys against him. Okay, now when that happens in a political system, like, there's some very serious truth and reconciliation that has to happen before you get back to, like, this is a real opposition. And so, you know, Trump has many virtues, he has many flaws, but he is really not under these people's control. They realize it. They really do not like it. If you're looking at the stuff coming out of the DNI's office now, you know, that's implicating centrist Republicans as well as Democrats as basically colluding in this Russiagate thing. Like, that's extremely dangerous to the whole system. Like, they're, you know, and I think that
Rubio, it probably implicates him too. He believed in Russiagate hoaxes.
It could.
I'm going to just finish.
And so the thing is, basically, you know, bringing this out is one of the best and most important things that the Trump administration can do. It's not a distraction from the business of government. It's like vitally important. It's what Trump was elected to do. He was elected to make America great again, but he basically, you know, told the truth that the first step in making America great again is beating these people. And that's his great virtue.
Clearly, Tulsi Gabbard doing something there. But just finally, and very briefly, Trump is threatening Iran again. Iran's people clearly have a desire now for nuclear weapons to enforce some kind of deterrent. No one knows where the 400 kilos of enriched uranium is after Trump's bombing of Fordow.
Certainly didn't blow up, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, so you think Trump...
I'm pretty sure it's an element. It's pretty hard to get rid of an element. You know, I mean, I think that...
But is Trump going to go in again as he's threatening when Iran's people oppose their own government and desire actual nuclear weapons because of what Trump did? And it'll this be the legacy because of all these nexus of powers on him?
It's disappointing because when you look at Iran today, you see a basically... Like, I'm not speaking about the government or the IRGC or anything. When I look at Iran today, I see a basically peaceful country. I see a country that basically, you know, where the regime is sort of built on this political formula of, you know, the liberation struggle and the fight against
Israel. Well, having said,
it's
the regime that can't have the nuclear weapons because of theology. It's the people.
Yeah, I don't think that there is any appetite in the Iranian public. If you could flip a switch and say Iran has a nuclear bomb, let's bomb Tel Aviv now. I don't think
just
they
for
would.
Deterrence.
I don't see that kind. I see the desire for deterrence there. Absolutely. I see the desire for, you know, basically peace there. Absolutely. But like that idea is fundamentally as ridiculous as the idea that Brezhnev wants to nuke Washington. You know, Brezhnev wanted those nuclear weapons for exactly the same reason. The USSR of the 1980s and the Iran of today strike me as actually very similar countries. They're post-revolutionary regimes. They do not have the fire of the 1980s. And, you know, of the 1980s in Iran. And, like, that fire is sort of the only thing that's really dangerous actually to Israel. And the problem is that the Israeli security state is basically, they do this thing called mowing the grass. Have you heard the phrase mowing the grass? This is like, oh, you know, Hamas gets too uppity and they have to bomb a bunch.
We'll have to get back to this. And Hans Hermann Hoppe and FDR in the cathedral.
Indeed.
And next time. But Curtis Yarvin, thank you.
All right. Great pleasure. Thank you, Alfred.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide in Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.